Hi, I'm Lawrence Diamond.
And I'm Bob Matthews.
And this is The Process of Production.
Wait, how's your week been?
This week has been great. We were meant to have an episode out last Monday, and guests we lined up and myself all got caught with a different lurgy that must have been going round. Obviously, there is the lurgy going round, but there's also loads of other things. And yeah, I was just knocked sideways. One of our guests cancelled due to illness last minute. And so we had to miss last Monday. So our apologies for that. But in answer to your question, now I'm great. I've had some antibiotics. I'm back on my feet and very excited for our guest this week as well.
Yeah.
Nice little story about how we came to interview him. Do you want to fill us in on that?
Yeah, well, some of you who are our regular listeners will remember we interviewed a lovely man called Chris Sheldon, who's a big-time mixer, has done a lot of rock stuff, including the Foo Fighters record, The Colour and the Shape.
And produced our favourite Biffy Clyro records, which we love talking about.
That was a big highlight for us. And after that episode came out, we had an email from another nice man called Tim, who said he loved the interview with Sheldon. And turns out that Tim was Tim Palmer, who's a huge time producer and mixer. And he's done some equally, if not more, seminal albums like Pearl Jam's 10.
Yeah, I read the interview, Bob, and I typed in Tim Palmer, and I was like, he produced David Bowie, he produced Robert Plant, he mixed 10 by Pearl Jam. And I must actually apologize to Tim, because I should have known who he was the minute I saw the email. Yeah. He's produced Ozzy Osbourne. And I was like, Bob, I think we should reply and say, Tim,
yeah,
could we interview you?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so we're super excited about interviewing him. And there was a certain woman in my life who was a big Pearl Jam fan who said, can you ask him if he can get her Eddie Vedder's number?
And you said, no.
I said, we'll see. We'll see if that comes up.
I know this is a strange thing to say, but just to talk to someone that has interacted with people like David Bowie and Robert Plant, let alone being involved in their creative process and producing music for them, was a real buzz. But I think once I got into the interview with Tim, I realized how kind of deep his knowledge was and how wonderful his approach to music was. And, you know, you're not working with people like that at such a young age, and then 15 years later, still creating new and exciting work, like all these things that you can't, his work on All These Things You Can't Leave Behind by U2. And him, we don't talk about it. We work with the Finnish rock band Him, who are great early noughties kind of pop metal band. And even now he's mixing jazz. I mean, he's a very humble guy and his stories are fantastic, but like, he's a real connoisseur of this art, isn't he?
Yeah, very much so. We asked him how he got to work with such, you know, huge stars so early in his career, and he'll tell you why in the interview. But I think what he didn't say was that it's because he's really talented and a really, really nice guy as well. I think that comes up a lot. That's why he kept getting these gigs and kept keeping them, is because people liked working with him, because he was good and he was a smart, sensible, affable person.
We always prep these interviews quite seriously, mainly because we enjoy doing it, but we want to really respect the work people have done. This was one of these interviews where the minute I asked the first question, I was like, Tim's going to take this where it needs to go, because he knows this better. You know, there's nothing we can ask. He's just totally in control of what he's done, and we got some great stories out of him. So yeah, a huge thanks to Tim for firstly listening and then writing to us, and then for agreeing to give us this time for this interview.
Yeah, and thanks to you guys for sticking with us. Sorry we missed last week, and we
will be back to fortnightly from here on in.
Or this one should have been worth the wait.
Yes,
fingers crossed.
Great, let's get to the interview. Take it away. Tim Palmer's CV is beyond impressive. Starting as an assistant at Utopia Studios in the 80s, he mixed worldwide smash I Just Died in Your Arms Tonight by Cutting Crew at the age of 21. This led to further work with 80s new wave bands like Kajagoogoo and the House of Love, which brought him to the attention of Robert Plant, the one-time Led Zeppelin lead singer who wanted more contemporary sound for his 80s solo work. This work on Robert's records brought him to the attention of David Bowie, who also wanted a fresh pair of ears on the production desk for what would become the Tin Machine project. Moving into the 90s, Tim turned his attention from production to mixing, and his work on 10, the debut album by an American rock band called Pearl Jam, catapulted him to the top of his profession. a fact that was confirmed when 10 years later he was heavily involved in mixing the U2 album All That You Can't Leave Behind. Production credits for, amongst others, Goo Goo Dolls, Tears for Fears, Texas, and even the Lord of Darkness himself, Ozzy Osbourne, confirmed Tim's place in the pantheon of modern production and mixing greats. When we started the interview, the most beautiful array of classic guitars were lined out on the wall behind him. So we started by getting the stories behind some of those incredible guitars before turning to the work with Plant, Bowie, Page, Osbourne, Bono, and countless others. I think you have the best backdrop of anyone we've Zoomed.
Oh, great. Nice. I'm glad.
Is that... are they some Gretches back there?
There's a whole bunch of stuff there. A lot of them are things that have been acquired during my long stint doing this for a living.
Amazing.
The Black Les Paul, for example, when I was working with David Bowie on the Tin Machine, I really wanted to have a Les Paul. And I'd always wanted one, and I was pretty young at the time, and I'd secretly wanted a vintage guitar, which I was not going to get, but I was able to get that guitar through David Bowie's deal with Gibson. He sort of basically said, "Oh, I need another Les Paul."
Yes.
And then Reeves Gabrels brought it over to me in London, and it has not for resale on the back, so it's special to me. The silver one, I don't know if you can see that.
That
I bought that from Johnny from the Goo Goo Dolls. And,
wow.
And the Telecaster was a Christmas present one year from The Edge.
That's a fantastic line.
Well, after I had the opportunity to work with U2, when we finished the album, and it's something that I did a lot of in the 90s, was to at least say to an artist that I'd worked with, look, if you do a TV show and you're worried about how the live audio is going to come out, mm-hmm. just get me a plane ticket and I'll go and sit in the booth with the engineer and just make sure that I feel the balance is good. And of course, you know, secretly, it was great for me, right?
Yes.
I mean, let's face it, you go to David Letterman's show and sit in the sound booth and work with U2. I mean, let's face it, there was something in it for me. There was definitely something in it for me as well. So that's how I got that guitar, was basically that was Edge's way of saying thank you for, you know, coming to all these things, which he didn't need to pay me for at all, of course.
You sort of alluded to something there, and it's kind of how I wanted to start the interview, if it's all right. You talked about working with David Bowie on Tin Machine. Producing a record for someone like David is the pinnacle of someone's career, perhaps, that they work 20 years building up towards. And you did it when you were 25?
25 or 26, yeah, which is something that, in a way, I wish it hadn't been at that point. I would like the opportunity to work with someone like David Bowie now that I have a lot more understanding of the craft and have been able to sort of figure out what I can do and what I can't do. But obviously, given the opportunity, you jump straight in.
Was it possibly maybe a blessing in disguise, in that you didn't sit there and go, do I deserve to be doing... It was just like young and ready to go in and...
I think so, yeah. I think so. I mean, there was definitely a case of being so young and in a way naive and not jaded and very excited about the concept. As I said, I think that some of the albums that I made early in my career, like getting the chance to do two albums with Robert Plant, that was even sooner. I was even younger.
Oh, so pardon me, I thought the Robert Plant came after, so that was even before the Tin Machine album. Wow.
Yeah, Plant's Now and Zen, which is probably his biggest selling solo album at that, it certainly was at that point, was in 1988.
Wow.
You know, I sort of, once again, as you said, my enthusiasm, I think, and determination was what kept me in the gig, because I made a lot of rookie errors in the studio working with Robert, and I remember things were taking a little longer to get done that maybe should have been a lot faster, and Robert complained about the studio, and the studio owner said, no, it's that's that kid in there, he doesn't know what the fuck is he doing. And luckily for me, Robert, you know, liked me, and I was having such a good time in the session that he didn't listen to that, and I stayed. But there was a couple of moments where it was a bit touch and go. So I wish that I'd had those opportunities later. But still, as you said, there's no replacement for that sort of ignorance is bliss and you know, naive charm or whatever you have, you know. It was working with David was an incredible opportunity for me. And it started off as the idea was to be working on a David Bowie solo album, and it didn't become a Tin Machine record until later.
Do you think that helped? Because it from how that record was made, it did seem more like, I suppose, that traditional band thing, and you were coming out of a punk world from your childhood and a maybe a new wave world. So you could approach it with that kind of head on of this band and this creation of kind of working in that way that maybe was a bit more traditional, rather than David Bowie is making his next solo record and there will be these collaborators. It was more that punk ethic. Is that too much to say? Or
no, I think that's right. There's no doubt that at the point that David made the Tin Machine record, he was ready to shed the skin of being the people's pop star. When he fell into that role of being a mega pop star with Let's Dance, he wasn't really very comfortable in that role. I think I was very fortunate to be in that transitional period when he went back to making music for himself and enjoying it again.
That's cool.
And I was sort of, in a way, I was an encourager and helped to be an instigator of that, because clearly, as you said, I was the young chap in the camp. I mean, David had a lot of experience, and Reeves Gabrels had played on a lot of records, and Hunt and Tony had played in Iggy's band. So they were a bunch of seasoned players in a way. And I was the young guy who was trying to capture the energy as best I could. When we talked on the phone before making that record, David asked me what Bowie albums I'd enjoyed recently or had been listening to, just because he knew that, you know, obviously having the chance to work with him, I would probably go back and listen.
Sure.
And I told him, that I was really, you know, my favorite at that particular time was the Lodger album. And that fit in actually perfectly with where he was going with it. And of course, the way the record sounded, as always with David Bowie, he had a finger on the pulse, and he was listening to Sonic Youth and Dinosaur Jr. and
amazing.
A lot of that sort of grungy or pre-grungy sounding records. Also, when you look back, I was lucky to be making that Tin Machine record before Pearl Jam or before Nirvana. And I think in a way that the general public had a problem with the idea of it, David Bowie being a member of a band.
Sure.
They didn't take to that particularly well. And also, I think it was quite aggressive, and so that was quite hard for some people to swallow too. But when you go back and compare it to Scary Monsters or The Lodger, it's not really that much out of place at all.
One thing we've talked with a lot with producers is getting that artist in that space. And often a producer can feel like a big brother, but almost here, I suppose you were the little brother with them a little bit of, you know, they're going to do a take. And was there a thing of like pushing them to those places where those touchstones were maybe of the kind of proto grunge stuff was a bit more normal to you or natural, and you going, you can do it like this, guys, or like, I'm gonna rack this up a bit more? Or I suppose from my perspective, even in my late 30s, telling the man who tracked all those vocals, this is how I'd like you to do your vocal today, David, I would find harder to do than if I was working with, say, an emerging artist. How did you get the band into the space to record, and how did you approach that relationship?
I think you're absolutely right in the sense that, being the younger brother, as you put it, I think I learned more from being in that situation than they ever learned from me, that's for sure. It was an incredible opportunity for me as a young engineer to be faced with this situation of, here's a bunch of great live musicians and they're going to play, and I've got to try and capture that. They didn't need a lot of encouragement from me. If you know the personalities of Hunt and Tony, they don't really give it your wish, you say, anyway. They're going to do it the way they're going to play it. And you're doing your best to capture that onto tape. But Hunt would do things like you'd carefully balance how you felt the drum set should be, and the microphones would be in specific places, obviously. And Hunt would be playing and he'd have his headphones or cans on, and if he didn't hear enough of his tom-toms, he would literally grab the tom microphones and pull them right down on top of the toms as he was playing, right? And you'd just be sitting there thinking, oh my God. That was the sort of way the session went. And as far as sitting down and having conversations about how do we feel about this song, how is the arrangement going to be, it was more a case of, right, let's do it. And they would go out to the studio, and there's a couple of tracks actually on the first record where you can actually hear the fact that I'm still dialing in the EQ, because I thought it was a run through. I didn't get a second go. Wow. Which was certainly exciting, but as I said, I think I learned more from those sessions than they got from me. I was just fortunately the one who was helping them capture this lightning in a bottle or whatever you'd like to describe it as.
And going back to that Robert Plant album, Jimmy Page plays on a couple of the tracks. It would be remiss of me not to ask what it's like tracking a legend like that.
Yeah, that was funny, I tell you. That was so funny. You, in the studio, as you know, you have assistants if they bother to come into the room, and sometimes they don't. See, where is that assistant? Where is he? And they're never there.
He's baking, been making tea for 25 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. So the day that Jimmy was coming in, suddenly I had two assistants who were there the whole time. And a maintenance guy who was fixing the rack at the back, which I thought was quite amusing because they knew Jimmy was about to arrive.
Amazing.
And Jimmy was exactly how you would, we'd all hope he was. He was a bit of a cartoon character of himself.
Amazing.
He had a man who'd arrived about 2 hours before to set up his amps the way Jimmy liked them.
Lovely.
Got all the Les Pauls, everything set up. And Jimmy strolled in with that big smile and talked to Robert. And I just was sitting back observing this whole meeting and just thinking, wow, this is incredible. And obviously with someone who has the skills that Jim does, you don't start telling him what he's going to be playing. And it was going to be a solo anyway. So he didn't need much guidance apart from I said to him, look, what I'm going to do is I'm going to open up a few tracks. You make sure you're happy with the balance and just do your thing, and we'll probably just choose our favourite bits later. And he was fine with that. So the guy who was his man put the Les Paul onto Jimmy, and Jimmy sort of got into the comfortable shape.
Oh, wow.
And then he also passed Jimmy a cigarette, which I thought was amusing. And then Jimmy had a drag on the cigarette and then put it at the end of his guitar between the strings, as you hope he would.
Yes.
And then he had a beer and he had a swig of beer. And then I played the track and off he went, and he pulled all the shapes, and it was fantastic.
Wow.
It really was. Wow. It was quite a special experience for me, that.
Moving on to mixing Pearl Jam and 10. I've read that the band flew over to England to be with you while you mixed it, which in this day and age seems unusual, but obviously that was much more common at the time. And that, plus the fact that Pearl Jam weren't yet really Pearl Jam, did those factors play into it being feasible to have them around and for there not to be too many egos clashing while you mix the record, whereas maybe now you might want people out the way or it might be done online?
For most of my career, the mixing stage involved the artist being present, even if it's just for the last 3 or 4 hours. We weren't sending files. Obviously, sending cassettes was very unrewarding.
Sure.
And the idea of A&R men having Mix's phone to play it down the phone was just ludicrous. But
amazing.
You know,
could
so
I have more low
important.
End, please?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the artists would come to the studio and sit with you, sit in the middle, and then they would tell you what they felt. And I'd say a good part of your career and your expertise at doing what you do was to be able to read the artist and say, okay, I know exactly what you're talking about. I get it. And then being able to transform the mix and make them happy. And actually having somebody next to you was actually a lot simpler than when you get a couple of lines in an email that are quite vague. And not only that, but it was an amazing opportunity to spend time with some of your heroes, or
even just people
who are bloody great laugh to be in a studio with and tell you some funny stories.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Now that's all gone. And I feel that we really have lost a lot. You know, Steve Lillywhite in an interview recently, the producer, Steve Lillywhite, he was saying that he wouldn't want to do the job nowadays. He never wanted to be a typist. And
I
mean, that's a little harsh, but I know exactly what he's saying, is that our job description has changed so far from what we started. But yes, going back to what you're saying, with the Pearl Jam situation, it was just standard that an artist wanted to be there at the mix.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about, I'd say, the 10 album, and also I think the nice thing about the Nirvana album in a way, is that there wasn't really a tremendous pressure because nobody really knew exactly how successful and how transformative those records were going to be. So there wasn't too much pressure on me from a label. I knew the A&R guy. He wasn't there. We mixed that record in probably about 12 days. And The band would come in every morning and, you know, listen to the mix. We'd make our changes and then we would move on. And it was as simple as that. And it was a very instinctive and fun session to be on. I loved what they'd done, so it was easy. Quite interesting to the story of the mixing is the fact that I was working a lot in LA previous to the making of the 10 album. And I'd worked on an album for Jimmy Iovine's new label, Interscope. And yeah, it was the first rock signing that he had. It was a band called Neverland. And they unfortunately were tinged with a lot of that sort of, let's say, hair metal, I think is kind. They weren't quite that far, but it was definitely in that vein of music that was about to die very, very quickly.
Sure.
And we made this record and it was great. It was a lot of fun. But when it came to the mixing, Jimmy didn't like what I'd done. And Jimmy, being the fact that he was an industry legend, and I certainly wasn't, he said to me, look, I don't really feel that the sensibility that you're bringing to this mixing of this record is right for America. Mm. And I was really, really upset and really disappointed, because I was starting to make my inroads into America. And I saw this as a tremendous setback. And I was quite depressed about it, to be honest. And the only thing I could say to Jimmy was, well, you know, if you are going to take my production and have somebody else mix it, can I at least be there? And he said, of course, you're the producer. You should be here. So came back and I sat and watched somebody else mix my record, which I'm happy to say hasn't ever happened since. But I watched them do it. And what struck me about the American way of mixing, and I'd only watched people mix records as an assistant in the UK, was how static it seemed to be. They balanced things up, the drums, and got a certain reverb and a reverb on the vocal, and you play the tape and the song played out, and it was very organic and simple, whereas I always approached a mix as if you're telling a story and each section is a new chapter, and you might need a different reverb on the chorus, on the snare drum. You might need a totally different effect on the vocal in the verses. And it was very different to the way they did it. And I was disappointed that I didn't have a chance to do that. And Jimmy saying that I didn't have the sensibility to mix a record for America hurt. But the nice part about it was that the next record I mixed was the 10 album. So I was able to stick my middle finger up and say, fuck you. One of the quotes I go back to, which I believe is the best cure for a bad mix, is a great song.
Yes,
and the thing that struck me when I heard the band the first time was the fact that Eddie's voice was very, very unique. Nobody sounded like Eddie Vedder at that time.
Sure.
And as we all know, that's when you're looking for something new, you know, how do we find that? Where is it going to come from? And if you've got a vocalist who has a voice that is instantly recognizable, whether it's Ozzy or Bowie or Leonard Cohen, you're onto a winner right away. And then if you give them good songs to sing, then we're really into it.
We're going to move on to talk about your work with U2 in detail, but I've read you talk about this idea of predicting songs or production mixing, particularly when you worked on that album, where you're not just being static with the stems you've got, but you're re-recording parts at mix phase, you're adding guitars or recording drums. That's quite a bold thing, especially, say, 20 years ago. Maybe it's a bit more normal now. Could you talk to us about how you brought that process into your workflow, how you developed it, how it felt doing that at the time?
In the old days, it would be very dangerous if you were presented with something that a producer had spent maybe 2-3 months refining and changing microphones and changing the live room to getting a deader room and getting the guitar tone just the way they want, for you to walk in and sneak up, double it with another guitar, they would probably hit the roof, right?
Yes.
So there was a lot more respect to the recorded material because you were mixing what they had done on the assumption that basically they were happy.
Yeah.
Nowadays, I think I assume most of the time going into most projects, not all, of course, but most projects that, you know, this is the best the band could do in the time that they had.
Mm.
So they know now, most people that I work with know what I do, and I say to them, look, what I'm going to do here is I will mix this and I'll give you everything that I've got. If I feel that there's a section that's too long, I'm going to edit it. If I feel that this chorus needs a high string part to elevate it, I'll put it on. If I feel that I want to you know, fix a few things, change some timings. I'm going to do it. And at the end of it, I'll play it to you. And if there's anything you don't like, I can mute it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I want to be able to have the freedom to give you everything that I feel it needs. And they, of course, most artists want that. I mean, yeah. the fact yeah. that you're prepared to do that for them instead of just mixing and just saying, there you go, that's what you did. Mm. You know, they love the fact that you care enough about what they're doing to try and elevate it, give it an extra 20, 30, sometimes even more percent.
Yeah.
So it's never been a problem. As I said, it's only going to be a problem if you start jumping into things without having a conversation first. Because some people are happy with the way they've got it and they just want you to mix it. And that's fine too.
Do you ever find the choice is too much? We've talked to other producers about missing the old days when they had those limitations.
Absolutely. And there is way too much choice. What was nice about the old days was that, you know, limitations make you become creative, of course.
Yeah. Mm.
So when
yeah.
you walked into a studio and you looked at the rack of gear, you go, okay, well, we've got a couple of 1176s for compressors. Right. So what am I going to use those 1176s? I'll use one on the bass and I'll use the other on the vocal. Have we got any others? No. Okay. That's fine.
Right. Yeah.
That's fine. What else have we got? And your mix in a way was colored to a degree by the room you were mixing in, right?
Yeah.
Not only was it colored by the acoustics of that room, because we were constantly changing mix rooms and you had to get used to their acoustics of that mix room, but your choices were colored by what was available to you, yeah. unless, you know, towards the end of the 80s, the American mix engineers would come in with a list of outboard gear they needed and yeah, they started to right. bring it in, which was the beginning of all that stuff. But now, yeah, you can pretty much have a compressor or three and yeah. three EQs on every thing you like, yeah. which is why everything yeah. starts to sound so, you know, when I listen to music now, I hear so much technology and not much humanity in a lot of, I mean, and I don't like it.
Have you set any boundaries within how you work for yourself? You go,
how do you keep that humanity, I guess?
Yeah, how have you kind of worked to keep that in your work?
I think the only way that I could answer that, honestly, is not because of a particular method, but because of the fact that in your head and in your ears, you know when you've gone too far, right?
Yeah.
So you tune something and you think, oh, I don't like the way that sounds.
Mm.
So you take it off, or you EQ something and you think to yourself, wow, it's sounding really small and yuck. I'll just take that compressor off. And then you go, oh, some life's come back to it.
Yeah.
So it really is just basically a decision you make that comes from your heart or your head that you think that something's not right. There's certainly not a simple method, because sometimes I'm as guilty as anybody of piling on the stuff.
Sure.
But if I'm trying to achieve something, I'm happy to be able to do that.
And from one of the first classic rock records of the 90s with 10 to mixing one of the first of the noughties in U2's All That You Can't Leave Behind, you know, working with a band like that on a record like that must feel like a real pinnacle. But I've also read that it could be quite frustrating, or at least a long-winded process where mixes would come together and then be redone elsewhere, then come back to you, and you never quite knew when something was done. What was it like being involved in such a huge project that sounds like it had so many moving parts?
Well, there's no doubt that working with U2 was a combination of a lot of emotions. It was very rewarding when something was finally done and they were happy with it. And it was very frustrating, the journey to get there. There was a lot of heads on a U2 project. You got Daniel Lanois, and, well, at least on this album, Daniel Lanois and Eno. And then you had the band who, you know, every member of that band, his input is as important as anyone else. So all of them have to be happy. And then on top of that, Steve Lillywhite was there and you have a label. So there's a lot of people to try and make sure are happy. So it could take a long time to get to the point where something's signed off on. And the band are notorious for changing their mind right up until the mastering, when Bono can be in the mastering room redoing a lead vocal.
Wow.
That's
so
amazing.
Even when
I love that. I can't believe that.
Even when you think it's been accepted, you might be wrong. You have to basically wait till you get the CD in your hand before you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there was one song on the album that I mixed called Elevation.
Yep.
And we worked and we worked and we worked on that song, and it was this and it was that. And then Edge has got an amazing memory for parts that he may have tried. And he has a bag that he carries with him with loads of CDs and cassettes. And you'll be working and he'll say, I think there's something that might work that I recorded in France. Wow. Let me have a look. And he'll go through and find a CD and he'll say, yes, listen to this. So he'll find a part and then he'll play another idea. But I used to call him brain the size of a planet, because that's the Edge. He's definitely nice. Like that. But, you know, you'd go on and on and on. And finally, we got to a point where everyone was happy with the mix. And I thought, OK, I've mixed the song Elevation and it's going to be on the U2 album. That's great.
Great.
Really happy. And then I rang, I went back to LA, and I remember ringing Sam, who's in charge of their studio there. And I said to Sam, they haven't remixed Elevation, have they? He said, nope. And then I rang a week later. I said, they haven't remixed Elevation. It's still my mix, right? And he said, there's a problem. And I was like, no, what is it? He said, Bono wants to redo the vocal. I'm like, well, that's it then. I'm huffed. Yeah. If he redoes the vocal, it'll be remixed. And he said, well, no, they just got him to sing on top of the mix.
Wow.
So it's the mix with just a few parts of new vocal that they slotted on top. So it is your mix. So if you actually listen to that mix, if you ever get the chance, listen to that mix again.
Yeah.
I can hear the fact that the vocal is not part of that same bus compressor.
Wow.
If you know what I mean. Because they took the mix that was through that and they put the vocal on top, and then they obviously put another, probably the mastering compressed it again. But it does seem a little separate, but it's still cool. But yeah, that's how on the edge it can be. So I still got the credit on that song.
So all their doors are really down. The flow between the writing to the production to the mixing and to even the mastering, it's all an open dialogue back and forth.
Oh my God! I mean, they obviously being in the position, an incredible position of having no budgetary. There's no budget restrictions. So a lot of the time with the band, they will mix something just to see how it's sounding, in a way.
Yeah.
So yeah. You could say, oh, let's give that to Mike Shipley. Let's see what he does with it.
Yeah.
And Mike might do something with it, and they say, wow, I love that. I love that effect in the verse, but I don't like the rest of it. So let's just take that, print that effect in the verse, and then that verse effect will be part of the song, and then it might be passed to me. And they say, mix this song, and I will be mixing it. And I'll think, oh, that's a cool effect in the verse, not knowing it was from a mix that Mike had done. But you inherit, wow. You inherit a lot of the time the work of people before you. I know for a fact that I worked on the song Beautiful Day, and I created certain things in delays and made some loops that, even though it wasn't my final mix, I printed them, and they were inherited by Steve Lillywhite, and I hear them in the final mix, some distortion things and stuff. So it's a constantly evolving thing where they're able to see what things stick and what things work and gather information from more than one source.
From a practical point of view, is there a manager who's tying all this together, or is it all the band?
It's the band, really, ultimately. In a way, it's strange, because you mentioned about how, as a producer or a mixer, how do you approach the fact that you want to try something without insulting anyone or treading on someone's toes or whatever? And the U2 record was quite interesting in the sense that for the predixing, as we called it, there were some things that I did that I thought, wow, well, they're going to either like it or I'm going to be asked to leave. Because when I mixed, before we started the album, I mixed a song called The Ground Beneath Her Feet. And on the way to the studio for my very first U2 mix, I was pretty nervous about it, as you can imagine. So I was driving to, I mixed it at Olympic. And I was back in the UK, and I was driving to Olympic, and my cell phone went off, and I answered it, and it was Bono, right? So I think, okay, here we go. So he says, look, you know, excited about the mix, but we don't like the drums. And I didn't want to, you know, be confused. I knew he needed to be positive. So I was like, okay, okay. He said, we don't like the way the drums are in these particular sections. And I thought, okay, I have no idea what you're talking about, but I'll when I start opening up the tracks, hopefully it'll become clear. So I listened to his note, and I went to the studio, and I realized as I opened up the session that there were some programmed elements that would keep coming in the early part of the song. Later in the song, Larry comes in and it's all big drums, so that's fine. But in the early part of the song, it kept going back to this loopy programmed drum thing. And I thought, well, that's obviously the part that Bonham doesn't like. So what to do? It didn't seem like there was much I could do with what they had. So I thought, OK, well, I'll just do it. So I rented a small drum kit and I got a ride cymbal and a snare. And I thought, what we need here is Walk on the Wild Side groove. So it just wants to be a little shuffle, just ticking over like that. So I thought, when the vocal's going in the verses, we'll just have a shuffle. I'll put a couple of splashes on the cymbal. And every time I do a little splash in the re-intros, I'll bring in the program drum. So we'll go from a natural loopy thing to the program. And then at the end, the big drums come in. And I didn't know whether they would be like, what the fuck are you doing? But they heard it and they loved it. And it was quite weird. But sometimes as a mixing engineer, you have to be prepared to take a chance and hope that it comes out well.
You say that kind of at the beginning of the production, you learned from Bowie. I suppose you learn from someone like Bono or Daniel Lanois, even though you're a very established mixer at this point. You must have taken some lessons that weren't just sonic from mixing that record and the way they approached that album, which was such a huge kind of comeback success.
You learn, and you also find things that you don't like, in a way.
Okay, yeah.
I just think that, you know, it's fine to be the hardest working group in rock, you know. That's a nice ethic, work ethic to have. But I think sometimes it just goes too far and you can lose the plot. I think there's good stuff that was left along the wayside sometimes because people were overthinking things.
I was going to ask if this kind of fastidiousness and attention to detail was the reason that you two are so great, but do you think it's just possibly a side effect of having an unlimited budget?
Trying really hard isn't always the best answer to music. You know what I mean? It's like you don't get rewarded for, oh, we tried really hard and we did lots of stuff. You know, the skill is to be able to say, well, no, we don't. Actually, sometimes as a producer, it's like, hey, guess what? We're going to do nothing.
Yeah.
It's great what you've done. It sounds fantastic with that simple guitar, that simple vocal, and a crappy little drum machine. Oh, don't you want to do that? No, I don't want to do it properly. Yeah. I want it to be a crappy drum machine because you've caught something there that is magic.
Yeah.
And to find something that's magic is the hardest thing ever. So let's keep the magic that you got, even though you recorded it in your bedroom, and we'll have that. And that's one of the nice things that we've got about with the technology. As soon as ADATs and things like that came along, you were able to, as a producer, go, okay, we'll try and better that guitar phrase at the front, but actually there's something about the way you played it and the sound you got that's sort of cool. So if we can better it, we'll have it, but if we can't, let's just nick it and who cares?
Yeah, and we can put it in the record
exactly
right now.
And who cares? Yeah. The most important thing, and that's definitely something where I totally agree with Jimmy Iovine, which he's done for years, is he'll try and record songs again, but if he likes that demo, that's the way it's going to be, and he'll use the demo, and he has done on many records, and I totally respect that way of thinking because, you know, being a producer, sometimes you have to be able to admit that, you know, doing things properly, as we say, or doing recording things properly, you lose something special about that first recording, and maybe it's just better to just use the demo and just fix up a few bits and mix it.
There's one last act you worked on that we'd like to touch on before we go to our kind of our stock questions. And you've got a wide-ranging CV, Tim, but co-writing with Ozzy Osbourne must have been a trip.
Yeah, it was great. I love Ozzy. It was fantastic. I mean, the fact that we were both from the UK, and he'd had a bit of a rough time on the album before, so he really didn't want to make a record. So part of what Sharon was thinking was, okay, you've worked with Robert Plant before, you've worked with David Bowie before, you can handle Ozzy. And maybe not. But Ozzy, you know, we would laugh about things that Americans wouldn't, you know, whether it be Monty Python lines or, you know what I mean?
It's like, the touchstones were the same.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, he loved the guards in the Life of Brian. And we would say, throw him to the floor very roughly. And we would burst into laughter, you know. And Ozzy was in, he was great. I mean, the writing thing happened because he'd made an album, he'd made many albums with Zach.
The Zach that Tim is referring to here is Zach Wilde, who's been the main songwriter and guitarist in Ozzy Osbourne's solo band since the late 80s.
And he suddenly decided, and this is not my decision, although as producer I sort of got blamed for it, but he wanted to write with different people. So he'd written a song with Mick Jones from Foreigner, a song called Dreamer, which is a lovely song.
Yeah.
It's one of his most streamed songs. And it's his, and Ozzy loves the Beatles, and it's almost like Ozzy's Imagine. It's great.
Wow, lovely.
And he'd written that with her. He'd written with all these different people. And we were getting songs coming in from Mike McCready, the guy from Alice in Chains, the guys from The Offspring. There were songs coming in everywhere. Wow. Everyone wanted to see if they could write one. And I figured, well, why don't I write something, right? I'll throw something in the ring. Why not? So I set up my Pro Tools in the dining room in my home. And I thought, what is it that people would like to hear out of Ozzy? And obviously the first thing that came to my mind was simply that, you know, with Sabbath and that, the guitar licks were very, very simple and very memorable. Mm. So just write some licks and put a few chords on, and then see what Ozzy comes up with. So I wrote a couple of tunes where it was basically around a riff, and I just submitted them with everything else, and Ozzy said he really liked it, and I was like, mind blown.
Yes.
And well, of course, as soon as he put his voice on there, I'd written an Ozzy song, and, you know, it was just, it was fantastic. Yeah, so many good times making that record. It was nuts. I mean, the band would leave, you know, Zach would leave the band and I'd be left trying to do pre-production without him, and then he would come back. But there was so many great moments with Ozzy on that record, I must say.
How do you helm a record like that with so many personalities kicking around? You know, how do you make a record with the King of Darkness?
Well, Ozzy wouldn't, getting Ozzy to the studio was always the challenging part. Once we reached the vocal part, then it was fun. But Ozzy needs a lot of, you know, he needs a lot of coaching and coaxing. But when he sings, it's funny because he has that, obviously, that famous vocal sound. And it's made up of, I got Ozzy to sing in the control room, which he had never done before, which surprised me.
Yeah.
I thought, well, you know, the guy's had a rough time on the last album. He's out there in a room with a pair of headphones, somebody's saying they don't like what you're doing. It's the worst. So as a producer, the nicer way to do it is to set somebody up next to you so you can be right there and say, hey, let's do this, right? Yeah. I'll help you. Well, let's do it. So I found a spot in the middle of the speakers and set the mic up so I wasn't getting too much spill. And Ozzy would be literally standing behind me. And he'd sing a first take and you'd think, okay, it's a little pitchy, but that's okay. And then he'd sing a second take and you'd think, okay, well, that was a little pitchy too, but not always in the same spot. So the two of them are starting to work together. And then the magical third take will also sing. But I don't know how he does it, but between the three, where one's sharp and one's flat, they work together, and then you've got the Ozzy sound, and there it is.
Yeah.
And it's fucking great. It really is.
Cool.
The thing about Ozzy at that point was that he was still the Lord of Darkness, and it was before the Osbourne show.
Right, yeah.
Yes.
So I was seeing the Ozzy that you know now from the show. Right?
Yeah.
Yes.
So we know what Ozzy's like on the show, and he certainly isn't the Lord of Darkness or a frightening figure in any way, but I felt a sort of, wow, I can't really say, I better not say exactly what Ozzy's really like because, you know, everyone thinks he's the Lord of Darkness. And then the show came out and I'm like, okay, well, we all know that, what Ozzy's like. He's so forgetful. There was one time we were recording vocals and it was a song that had been written by someone else and he was still learning it. And he said, okay, you got to count me in, man. I said, okay, I'll count you in, no problem like that. So I'd run the tape, and he was behind me. I'd run the tape, and I'd say, okay. I'd turn, and I'd say, 3, 2, go. And Ozzy would go, and he'd be off. And I'd say, okay, great. And we'd do another one. And then I'd forget, and I'd be at looking forward, and he's behind me. And I'd play the track, and there'd be nothing. And I'd look around and he'd go, "You didn't count me in, man." He still wouldn't. He needed you to be there
every single time. Yeah,
amazing.
Shakespeare once said that music is the food of love. But what is the food of music? As much as the right microphone or guitar amp, what we eat or drink can be such a crucial part of a recording session. So each week we like to ask our guests, what do they cook or order to get the mood right in the studio?
In the 80s and 90s, being able to work in residential studios was great. I certainly didn't cook anything. And the studio cooks were usually pretty phenomenal. With Ridge Farm, we'd have dinner with Pearl Jam. And the U2 record, we were in Dublin, and we were working in their studio. And they used to have a big circular table, like the Knights of the Round Table. Yeah. And that was pretty, for me, that was pretty mind-blowing, because you'd all be working, they'd be working in one studio tracking with Daniel, and I'd be mixing in another room, and we'd all join up for this dinner. And to sit at that table, you know, because obviously you've got Larry and Edge and Bono and Adam sitting there, and then there'd be Jimmy Iovine would be there sometimes, and Mike Shipley would be there sometimes, and Steve Lillywhite would be there, and Lanois and Eno and myself, and
flipping
and,
heck,
and like you're sitting around,
Jesus.
And it was pretty interesting listening to the conversations. It really was.
Yeah.
That's the podcast I want, is the microphone in the middle of that table.
And we, I think we went out for a few meals when we were in Switzerland with Reeves Gabrels and with David Bowie, and that was pretty special too, I must say.
You must have been sitting there as a young man just going, "Oh my gosh, I'm in Montreux."
It's funny because I look back at those things, and it's like anything in life. I feel like I think you appreciate things when you're far away from it and think, I should have appreciated it even more than I did.
Yeah.
That was special. And, you know, going to his house, and we went up to his house in New York in one of his brownstones, and he got out some of his old records, and we were sitting listening to records and things like that. Now I would die to have those experiences all over again. I really would.
What's your favourite reverb?
Well, I used to love the echo plates and echo chambers. And then in the 80s, I loved the Lexicon 224. So I'd say at the minute, my favourite is the Capital plug-in for the Capital plates. I use that on pretty much everything, and it just has a great sound. I love it, really do.
And your favourite delay?
My favourite delay, I'd say, is one of the sound toys. Once again, it's about... you know, it's about being able to get to where you want fast. And for me, the Echo Boy Junior, I can saturate it. I can roll the top end off. I can get it just everything that I need to do happens fast with that plugin. So I'd say that's my go-to for most delays.
How about your favorite compressor?
My favorite compressor is it's called the Wolf compressor.
Oh yeah,
nice.
And it's so weird, you know, because compression's always that mysterious, mythical, I don't know, but
sure,
people have all these ideas and there's all these theories and stuff, but there's something about that particular compressor that really seems to do its job, but it doesn't fuck with the sound too much. And I can get things to be really steady and sit where I want them to, without them sounding overly compressed, but bring up the stuff I want. And it's really quite an extreme compressor. You can really do a lot with it. You can, if you're using it on a room, you can make a room sound massive, but you can also do very subtle things with it. And it's not particularly expensive, but I really like that compressor. I'm using that a lot. I mean, there's a lot of compressors I use, but if I had to pick one, I'd say that one is a favorite at the moment.
Your favorite synth?
I mean, in the 80s, I loved the Jupiter 8. It was great, great fun synth, that one. That was used on so many of those, you know, those 80s-sounding records.
Yeah.
The JP-8 was fantastic.
Finally, yes, what's your favourite microphone?
Well, I guess I would have to go with the most versatile mic ever, which I'm sure is probably the number one microphone that people have said, which is an SM57 or a 58, right? Because
We've had a lot of SM7 as well, actually. But
That's nice.
Yeah.
I mean, the SM57 or 58, I mean, the fact that you can use it on drums, on a snare drum, one of the best snare drum mics ever. You can use it on guitars. And I recorded Bono and David Bowie and I don't think Ozzy, but those, they were both recorded on those microphones too. So you can do anything with it, really.
We do always ask this question, and you can answer it in any way that you see fit. What is the most important tool at your disposal as a producer?
Is your brain.
Mm.
It's your own sense of musicality and instinct of what you think is right. You can be taught all this stuff about how to do things, but your decision-making comes from your own mind and your own love of music and your own objectivity of how you think something should be. And anything that you do, anything you change, is all driven by what's going on in your head. So I would definitely say your own mind or your own brain or however you want to put it is the most important thing.
I mean, it feels like you could take one of a million things from that interview, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just pick something at random. But one thing that struck me talking about the Pearl Jam record was, you never know what's going to go, what's going to blow up, what's going to be the thing, and it's just kind of heartening to hear them talking about just doing the work, not too fussed about the trend that was on the horizon, which was grunge. I sound like they just did their album as it should be, you know, respected the songs, respected the artists, respected the talents and, you know, the unique things of the band, like Eddie Vedder's voice and so on, and got a great record and the success came after.
Yeah, I read an interview that Tim had given. He was working on a new Tears for Fears album and Roland Lothabel, who's the lead songwriter, had done his astro chart for him. It's like astrology chart.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, in the near future, you will be involved with something in your work that is a worldwide success. And Tim said, well, I've just mixed this rock record for this band on a label in America, but right now I'm working on a Tears for Fears album, so it's probably this Tears for Fears album. And he's like, well, it came true, but it was this record that I'd kind of mixed, really enjoyed doing, thought it was a great record, and then was getting phone calls from my manager every month going, it's number 37, it's number 25, it's number 12, da, da, it's number one, it's the fourth biggest selling record of the year. And as you say, like, and as Tim said, no pressure, just a really enjoyable experience.
Yeah.
I think I really enjoyed Tim's honesty about each project he'd been on and you know, recognizing with David Bowie and Robert Plant, he was kind of learning as much from them as they were from him. And that was a lovely story about Robert sort of kind of going into bat for him because he realized how important his other skills were. And then 15 years later, where Tim's one of the biggest mixers in the world, and thus he's brought on to mix this huge U2 record.
Yeah.
He's still learning the lessons then, and he's still interacting with the artist. And he's doing it in a different way, but he's still pulling everything on board and feeding back. And
just stayed humble.
Stayed humble, but also stayed sure of who he was.
Yeah.
And not let the outside noise, whether that be maybe I'm not qualified enough in some ways to do this, or maybe there's 17 voices on this U2 record.
Well, yeah, you can't, I suppose the lesson is that you can't get too bowled over and caught up in the moment. You have to live in the moment, but you can't overthink it and overanalyze it. And I think a kind of side effect of that is the slightly more kind of plaintive moments that we had in that interview where Tim was like, I wish I'd appreciated those moments a bit more when I was in them. But I think you can't have it both ways.
No.
You can't be in the moment and also be reveling in it and being like, wow, wasn't this amazing? Because then you're not really living it.
There's too much to do to stop and go, wow, I'm in a mixing room with Bono, because you're probably EQing the vocal, making sure everything's set up, and like, you've got to get the performance.
It's sad, but that's kind of life. You don't know what's special until later, and you just have to live it, and that has to be its own reward, really.
And another thing you realised, and Tim touched on it when he was talking about going for the meals with people and stuff, like, music is its own reward. I mean, making records, I was talking about this recently with friends and about choosing life as a musician. Making records and playing songs for people is the thing I think is the greatest thing in the world. Like, Yeah. It just turns me on in a way nothing else does. But I'm also conscious that all the things that come with it are really wonderful too, like meeting people from different walks of life and playing shows or being in the studio with world-class musicians who and watching them play, and the reward of having a career in music if you're lucky enough to, or even having part of your career in music, as I'm sure a lot of us do. Mm. It is a gift in itself, and nothing is about money or status. It's just about this beautiful thing. And some of those stories Tim told made you realize that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Going for lunch in Montreux with David Bowie, game on. It's all good.
When Jimmy Iovine said, maybe you're not the right mixer for US, you know, it basically means you're not going to be a successful mixer. And
Go back to Europe.
Yeah. And like your weird British sensibilities are right for that market, but not for the biggest music market.
Yeah, and that's like one of the three biggest record execs. Like, you're like, that door's closed.
Brutal. Yeah. But then that led to doing 10. So,
yes. And I think Tim was really honest about how much that would have knocked him. And he's 6 or 7 years into a very successful career then. So that's a lesson for all of us, isn't it? You know, big, important people who know what they're talking about sometimes get it wrong. And you just got to keep your faith, take the knock, and move forward.
And no one's like invulnerable from that criticism. You're gonna feel it, and you just have to kind of ride the waves of like, oh, that hurts, and that's a stinger, that one.
I also thought how brave it was of him, and kind of maybe because it paid to my sensibilities when he said, yes, it was amazing watching that U2 machine have all those options.
Yeah.
But I don't necessarily think that's how you should make music. Yeah. And that's like, he's mixed songs on one of the definitive rock records of the last 25 years. And he's gone, I love the songs. I love the process. The band are incredible.
Yeah.
I still think they could have been incredible without going through all these things. And to circle back to Page and Plant, Led Zeppelin 1, 26 hours. They went into a room, they hit record, and they came out the room. Wow. You know, it's different music. There's different things at play. But you don't have to do it that way. The reason that record works is the songs are great. So whatever it took to get to the songs being great, fantastic. I mean, wow. Yeah, I said when we finished this interview, this could be 2 episodes and we could have talked to Tim longer. He was so generous with his time. But I've learned a lot, and it was an absolute pleasure doing that interview.
I mean, I've learned a lot too, and I hope everyone out there has too. I can't see how you wouldn't have with so many pearls of wisdom from a great man like Tim. So yeah,
and so many big names. I mean, we bought the A-list today.
Yes.
We absolutely bought the A-list.
One of those.
Next week, we're going to be interviewing Emily Underhill, who performs under the name Tusks, and it's going to be a real kind of interesting dive into like a self-producing artist and an artist who's building her own path and is maybe a different part of the process. But I'm fascinated to speak to Emily, and we are delighted to be back to coming to you every 2 weeks.
Yeah. See you then, guys. Thanks
see you
for
then.
Listening. Thank you for listening to The Process of Production this week. If you enjoyed it, please give us a follow and maybe even a 5-star review on whatever platform you listen to your podcasts on. It really helps. And please get in touch if you have any thoughts on the show, questions you'd like answered, or producers you'd like to see interviewed. We'd love to hear from you. Our Instagram is @processofproduction and our email is processofproductionpodcast@gmail.com.